Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 15th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Disability and the Politics of Care, presented by Nancy Iceland, disc number EIN 2005-03.
I can't recall your name.
Karen
is going to be leaving. But we're going to have a little more conversation. Karen, do you mind coming up here? It won't bother us at all. Would you mind filling on it up here? She has dish team. So if it seems at a critical moment in the discussion she departs, we don't have to. We won't take mutual offense. I'm Nancy Iceland, and this morning we're going to talk about disability and the politics of care. And this is one of those ones I'm appreciative of you coming. As I realized when I put it on the description, I thought, you know, I don't have any idea how this will fly in this context. So, and the truth is, it's the one that I think of as coming the last in the series. But Paul was rejiggering things, and it got to the fourth spot rather than the third spot rather than the fourth. But there's no sense that any of these are sequential. They're all freestanding. And this comes out of my most recent work, in which I'm trying to think about feminist disability theology and the nature of mothering, and taking on this question of the politics of care. Because it's a complex set of issues, and we have a lot of work in it. So we're going to kind of break down the pieces of it, try to have more conversation than me just saying things to you, and then hopefully at the end we'll have provocative new ideas that you all can give me that I can take home and work on as well. You know, in the conversation like this, I'd really like us just to go around and say our names. I know we can't remember our name, everyone's name, but at least gives us a social fiction.
Karen.
Okay.
Ruth.
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 Ruth. Ruth. And Ruth. Well, I'm gonna bet I can remember a Ruth.
My name is not Ruth.
Barbara and those.
Sally.
Richard.
Matt.
Hildy.
Jim.
Ray.
Lenore.
Two Lenores. Three Ruths, two Lenores.
And Stacy.
And Stacy. All right. All right. Well, some of you have, this is the first time you may have thought about both disability and the relationship of the politics of care. And I'm a person with a lifelong disability, reared in a family with two children with congenital disabilities, one with a developmental disability, and one, myself, with a profound physical disability from birth. So my experience of this is going to be both from a situation in which the family of origin had not only my circumstance of needing care, but my sister, my eldest sister's circumstance. And then now, thinking about it in relationship to the fact that I am a caregiver of my daughter. My daughter is three, she's running around and you hear her at worship. I think Ruth the other night was sitting next to us. There's almost no way to keep a three-year-old entirely happy through worship, but she did. She has prompted me to think again about this question of dependence, independence. What is the nature of care, and how is it related to feminist accounts, right? Because that's one of these thorny issues in feminism, and we're going to talk a little about different feminist theorists, a little bit, not a whole lot, but a little bit, just to say sort of what they have contributed to the conversation. And then what we think may need still to be done in relationship to it. My assumption about disability and my working definition of disability is not the same as everyone's. So it's important that I get it out there and be clear about it, because I work in what's a relatively new intellectual intellectual field, which is called disability studies, and really was one of the early people working in disability studies. Now it's about 10, 12 years old. But it's increasingly kind of formed, and so increasingly we work on trying to understand disability in ways that are similar to how we've thought about sexual orientation, race, gender. So it's not as though we're working on something absolutely new. We are scaffolding, I often say, scaffolding on the work of other folks and trying to make an accessible scaffold, which is no small feat, in ways that allow us to think about disability as part of the system that works, that creates power, access, and opportunity in our society. I am a sociologist, trained as a sociologist. I'm a theologian, I say, by necessity, because I was trying to find theologies that made sense of my experience of lifelong disability, and I just frankly could not find them. They were not available, and so my mentor, Rebecca Chopp, said, well, why don't you write something? And I thought, well, that seems entirely precocious. So I wrote something for my very private sense, and then she had encouraged me eventually to send it in. That is the book entitled The Disabled God, which I'm going to talk about tomorrow. But today I'm working on this other piece, which is a part of the overall project, which is to think about an emancipatory transformation that includes disability, to work with communities like Holden, like my institution, that call for full inclusion, that want to be places of welcome and hope, and work with those communities to practice empathic hope with people with disabilities. I know that it's been, for the last while, part of the mission of Holden, part of the explicit mission. It may have always been part of the implicit mission of Holden, but it's been part of the explicit mission of Holden to be accessible, to be particularly welcoming to people with disabilities. And of course, for those of us with physical impairments, the wilderness is not a place we've often been, other than, you know, like downtown Atlanta, which is a different one entirely. And of course, you know, different places create different forms of disability for us, right? I have a mobility impairment, and my mobility impairment becomes greater when I'm in a context where I have to go up lots of stairs, right? Doesn't mean that I physically have altered anything, but the disability becomes greater. And so that's the context in which we think about this wonderful wilderness. We also think about, well, for some people, it's a new kind of challenge, and the way in which Holden is going about helping the community think about how to figure out an accessible wilderness is an important part of their mission. So this is the definition of disability with which I work. It is, disability is a cultural interpretation of human variation rather than an inherent inferiority, a pathology to cure, or an undesirable trait to eliminate. As a person with a profound impairment, I have to say that this has at various points been challenging to me. I'm not saying that these are, you know, when we give definitions, it doesn't mean, yes, the light goes on in my intellect, and I suddenly, sometimes we have to struggle with this. But people say sometimes, well, what about real impairment? And as I just said with the mobility impairment, I have real limits, but you have real limits too. And you encounter those limits in different contexts, and they aren't maybe societally as organized and systematized as the way society is in relationship to the limits of disability, right? So that limits is not something unique to folks with disabilities. It is part of the human creation. And the fact that we have, over time, created certain kinds of good limits and other kinds of bad limits is a part of this scaling of bodies that feminists have talked about. You know, Aristotle thought women were misbegotten men, right? Not that they were just another form of human creation to be appreciated, enjoyed, supported, and encouraged. Well, the same has been the case with folks with disabilities. And this is the case, I would say, for the range of disabilities, right? It's not just the case for those of us with what are, for many people, relatively easy disabilities, right? I don't have the kind of disabilities that for many people hit the bottom of the scale and make us really want to exclude folks with, people with physical, facial deformation, one of the highest. People would less like to be around people with facial deformation than people who were imprisoned. There's, you know, so all of our scales of folks we don't want to be around, folks with facial disabilities sort of are right in the bottom, in part because of our image of who the human person is and the kind of anxiety that that produces within us. Also, people with profound developmental disabilities all have different kinds of challenges. But my argument is, and the argument of folks in disability studies is, that doesn't change the notion that there is, that human variation is really constant. Right? Human variation is not something that is a new phenomenon, exactly, right? You know, the fact that folks survive with more forms of human variation is relatively a part of the 20th century. On the other hand, human variation has been a part of what I would say, disability studies folks are secular mostly, what I would say is a part of God's blessed creation. That's what human variation really is, whether it's ethnic and racial or gender and transgendered and gay and lesbian or folks with disabilities and a range of disabilities. We teach one another about the great opportunities of creation. All right, so that means starting out thinking that disability is an interpretation of human variation, not the human variation itself, right? Because that we would say, okay, that's pretty constant across, but it's an interpretation, right, of the human variation. Rather than, as we've said here, an inherent inferiority in which we can say, these are good ones, those are bad ones. We, you know, somebody was asking me yesterday after a session about suffering. And I said, you know, people with disabilities aren't the designated driver of suffering. we don't necessarily have more social suffering than lots of other groups, right? We don't carry all of society's suffering. My experience is not defined by suffering. Right? So in some ways, disability, the link between disability and suffering is one of the hardest to decouple because we so assume that's the case. For lots of people, their disability, you know, there's the activist group with which I have long been associated. Our main motto is disabled and proud, right? Taking a sign from the Black Power movement. Many of the folks, they're think not at all that they are experiencing suffering as a part of their disability. They don't have pain in their body, it's relatively stable. For lots of people, whether you identify as disabled or not, your limits create for you certain kinds of suffering. That is part of the human condition that we have to deal with in lots of different contexts, but it isn't the special problem of disability, I would say. The same way that maybe suffering isn't the special problem of women. The pathology to cure. That's not a pathology to cure. You know, I was just talking with Beth that's a challenge for folks across the range of experiences with disability and without. Of course, as a person with a congenital disability, I have no idea what it would be to be without disability. Certainly, I know what it would be to be without certain elements of my disability, which I find less or more acceptable over time, but who would I be without a disability? I have no earthly idea. So the notion that I should have this removed from me would leave me without a personality, a personhood, a self. But for people who have traumatic onset disability in later life, the notion that they need a cure has often been not only a personal passion for them, but it's often been society's way to tell them how to get back in, right? What happens with folks with traumatic injury disability is not just that they experience maybe physical suffering, of course they do that, but they suddenly are identified with this disgusting social group, right? The social group that actually, you know, disgust is a kind of a visceral experience. It's not one of those things we kind of think about. And people, that's one of the most profound ways in which people talk about the experience of certain forms of disability. Their experience with it is just kind of a visceral, kind of jarring sense. And to be suddenly moved from being, like, say, Christopher Reeve, a white male with certain kinds of power, whether or not this was superpower, certain kinds of social power, to being associated with this disadvantaged group of folks. And of course, within disability, there are the challenges of cross-disability solidarity, and being associated with folks with different forms of disability also makes folks within the disability community face those challenges. So suddenly, the notion that it's a pathology to cure is also not part of the definition. And then finally, or an undesirable trait to eliminate. This is sort of that notion that disability is a matter of will, right? I have my father is beloved to me. He is a good man. But my father was of that Second World War generation in which the matter was simply of pulling yourself together and getting on. And it was really a matter of willing yourself better and willing yourself beyond pain. And as my father's experienced more disability in his later life, he's been realized it's not always just a matter of willing yourself to eliminate these things that shape the contours of your life. All right. So just as feminism challenges the belief that femaleness is a natural form of physical and mental deficiency, so feminist disability studies questions our assumption that disability is a flaw, a lack, or an excess. Right? So we begin kind of peeling away some of our ways of defining disability so that we can begin the work of feminist disability theology. And that's really what I had just sort of put up here in bullet points. As I got to the bottom, I didn't have time to write up my full sentences. So these are more fully formed here. The work of feminist disability theology understands disability as a system for scaling bodies that stigmatizes human difference and marks some bodies for exclusion. Right? That's part of the work of feminist disability theology, trying to understand the system of scaling bodies. Second, it uncovers communities and identities that we have considered disabled. It uncovers the communities and identities that we have considered disabled and what they have produced. It's not exactly well formed here. But let me tell you what that means. The civil rights movement of African Americans in the U.S. gave us certain kinds of language and frameworks for understanding the possibilities of inclusion, right? It gave us ways to think, and that's what the history of rights movements through time have done. The fact that the Christian church knows almost nothing of the disability rights movement, includes almost none of its major events in its liturgical year, thinks not about the kind of key characters and the way in which they produce new frameworks for understanding disability, and Ed Roberts and the Rolling Quads of Berkeley, and the way in which they transformed educational notions, and the way in which we thought certainly quadriplegics couldn't get higher education. That would be an absolute exception. Those sorts of really fundamental parts of our history have been lost for the Christian church and the Christian reflection. And so then it's not surprising that we fail to honor some of those important folks in our past that have really moved us further along the way and don't have the ways to think about disability that, for example, the civil rights movement has given us. The disability rights movement has given us similar ways to think about disability and images and stories and songs and practices. But because that history is really lost to the Christian church, it hasn't been a part of our story, we don't have that hidden history as a part of our story. Third, it reveals discrimination and discriminatory attitudes that are directed at bodies. Yesterday I talked a bit about the ways in which when people hear disabled God, there's always this, you know, whether or not audibly. Once in a while, I actually hear it audibly. But sometimes I just, I can kind of see this kind of, oh, goodness, that's bemusing. And in part, it is because of this devalued notion, on the one hand, and the vaunted notion of God, on the other hand, omnipotent, omniscient. That's nothing like disabled, right? So, how do these two things come together? And part of the way that, part of just that juxtaposition often highlights for us the discriminatory attitudes, right? Just the ways in which we think that's not a possible way to think about people with disabilities as well as that category. But there's all different kinds of ways. Folks have given me stories of people with disabilities who've been pastors in their context. But the truth is, for many folks who would like to fulfill their call from God as a clergy person and who are people with disabilities, the road is inaccessible. It's uphill at best, and they need a good bit of support to get to that place, in part because of this politics of care. We want our pastors to be ever there, ever being careful for us. And the notion that people with disabilities can care for others is not a part of the category, right? It is, they're dependent, they receive care, they're going to be a burden on the congregation, we're going to have to do all kinds of things to our facility, to our et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it gets to be an ordeal. And who wants to have a pastor that starts with an ordeal, even if the ordeal is not related to the actual person at all? It's the construction of disability that creates the mental ordeal that we are already imposing upon ourselves. And then, as feminist theology has always helped us focus, feminist disability theology helps us think about the ways in which power works, right? Power is one of those, you know, and as a sociologist, this is the dilemma going from sociologist to theologian, you know, theologians can be a little loosey-goosey with the notion of power at some time, you know, and it sort of floats, and some groups have. Sociologists, we want to kind of nail it down. We want to operationalize it, as we say. We want to figure out how it moves. Power's not that way. And so us sociologists have to deal with that tension that power is fluid. And as a construct, it's a sensitizing concept rather than something we can absolutely define. And it's always, in certain ways, relative to a particular, specific context in which we're working. So we can't start out, sometimes people would, you know, they used to be, a friend of mine and I used to teach what students happily called Oppression 101, which was sort of, you know, a certain kind of social analysis, but, and it's a good note, social analysis, but we would often start with the who's at the top, who's at the bottom, you know, how do we think about, well, power works like this in society in certain ways, and we can, especially in class and race. But gender, disability actually is one of them that does work pretty well. But once we kind of start keeping on thinking about the intersectionality, this word that we talk about, the kind of multiple ways in which power people have and don't have power, then we can't use this the nice pyramid of who's at top and who's at bottom always. We have to think, and it's always complex. And even those, you know, the kind of, there used to always be in Prussian 101, there'd be, when we put this over on the table, on the board, there'd be this kind of sinking of young white men in the back of the room, because they always were in the back of the room. And I used to say, you know, we never can tell. We can't tell if those young white men have forms of disability that are invisible to us. We can't tell their class situation. So that we have to refigure, even though we know certain kind of characteristics tend to carry with them power, we can't always assume that that's the case. So this is what the work of feminist disability theology is, and you're probably at this point thinking, that's a lot of definition, I'm not sure I came here for that. Well, we're going to sort of slow down and stop and ask if there are questions or comments, and I'm going to give some illustrations. My husband always told me to stop and give illustrations, and he don't give enough illustrations. So, questions, comments about this? In many ways, this probably isn't so alien. I mean, it's just kind of the work of feminist theology. It just incorporates disability or work of liberatory theologies generally. Questions? Bemusements? Well, then let's come back to that, because I'm sure I will create some. The challenge in feminist theology has been this question about an ethic of care. Are women the particular carriers of an ethic of care in the social world in which we live? And if they are, mostly it's because they, which end of care do you think, I mean, which end of care are they on, usually, as we think about the ethic of care?
Caregiver.
They are on the giver side, right? They are, women have historically understood and in many ways practiced the sustaining of society through the nurturance of children. I always talk about, liberalism as a political philosophy necessitates that people spring out of the heads of other adults, because it doesn't really provide for the nurturance of children. It's just not in most of those liberal political theories. And so the question always is, where are the children? How do they get cared for? Where are the elders? How do they get cared for? This isn't part of the civic society. This isn't part of what we constitute the important work of getting together and gathering around questions of what is right for global warming and how ought we to act together in relationship to social policy, right? Behind the scene of that is all this necessity of care. And in this, the politics, this ethic of care, actually, often, it's assumed that there is a kind of unidirectionality. Let me say here, I'm going to take this down. There's a unidirectionality of care, meaning women give more than they get, which we may think is empirically accurate, but I'm going to trouble it as a theory. There's this thing called care, and there are givers and getters. Or those who give care and those who are the recipient. And usually, within the ethic of care, early literature anyway, those were two different popular sets of people, right? The children were the getters of care. The mothers were the recipients of care. Even later in some of the elder care literature, in the feminist elder care set, it still was this there was an asymmetry that was a kind of what I call the tipping point, right? The point at which the elder has to be the getter and not the getter, right? That, you know, all of us have parents of some, and at some point there is this sort of, there's this period in which, you know, there's a kind of possible equality, but then there's the tipping point in which the direction of the asymmetry shifts. And part of the question that the mothering problem, and I raise it in relationship to disability, is that with women with disabilities, even more intensely than women in general, we have been cast in the cultural imagination as inferior, as lacking this capacity to care, and being the recipients of care rather than the givers of care. Whereas non-disabled women must struggle to escape the mandate of motherhood, disabled women must battle to claim motherhood if they're going to have it. And so much of in feminist disability stuff, there's a lot on pregnancy and fertility and a lot of that. And in feminist ethics, feminist Christian ethics, there's been a good bit of production around the position of a mother with a child with a disability, producing ethical work on this ethics of care. You might have heard of Christine Gudorf, wonderful, or Frances Young from Great Britain, or most currently Ava Feder Kate, who has done a book entitled Love's Labor Lost. Yesterday, people asked me if I was on, put stuff on the board. So. Each of them writes and contributes to this feminist ethic of care, in particular a Christian ethic of care, from the position of mothering a long-term dependent child with a disability. And I am, let me just say, I am particularly sensitive and cognizant of this fact because my mother is the long-term caregiver of a child with a good deal of dependency. And one of the things that all, several things that each of these people contribute to the conversation is a discussion about the challenge of maintaining mothering in that mothering is supposed to be, in some ways, a seasonal thing, right? It's one of those things, yeah, my mom says, oh, you never get done being a mother. On the other hand, love my daughter as I do, I'm really looking forward to the end of diapering. Yeah, this is a thing that there's no great glory in the carrying of poop. It just doesn't, you know, doesn't give me any personal sense of great satisfaction. It does give me a sense that, you know, she's not hurt, and that's a good thing. But mothering is a kind of season. It's supposed to be a certain seasonal thing. And my mother always talks about the period in which, in the 50s and 60s, mothers were to blame for just about everything that was wrong with their children later in life. And, I mean, I was in rehab hospitals a good bit as a child, and ended up being a March of Dimes poster child. And my mother was interviewed for this. It was a kind of a poster child syndrome. I've threatened to write about this sometime. There are some people who have written bits about it. But my mother was invited to talk about what it meant to have a child that would be, at that point in my life and that point in society, the assumption was I would not marry, I would not work, I would not have an education, that I was going to be her burden for life. Right? And that creates a context of tension that means mothers are responsible for everything. Right? And it's a tension that was acted out in, you know, the notion that autism, early on the theory that autism was about the refrigerator mother, it was called. Right? So that all of these folks write very useful, and I'm not trying to undermine their usefulness. I'm trying to give another perspective from disability on it. very useful work that highlights grief, denial, normalization, codependence. All of these things are extremely vital for the conversation and a part of the conversation. And Kate provides an excellent critique of the notion of equality. Right? Equality is both something that is the goal, often in disability rights, and it's sort of out there as this generic necessity of American society. And she argues that equality repudiates human dependence and the need for mutual care. It's based on a freestanding adult male norm, and that it can't manage the asymmetries of care and the necessity of mutual care. But one of the challenges of this work is that it does tend to essentialize mothering and disability. And so when I early on, not just here, but in other work, when I early on started talking about my desire to write about mothering and disability, people automatically assumed that it was related to mothering a child with a disability, right? Because that's the normal pattern of this care going. One gets and the other gives, and a mother with a disability can't appropriately mother a child in many ways in our concepts. So part of what a feminist disability theology, I think, does is bring another sets of stories, the stories of mothers with disabilities, to this conversation about care. Right? Who gets it? Who gives it? My daughter is... when my daughter came, I had to have emergency surgery, and I ended up on my back for about 5 months, really not able to do much at all. And this was of great, great anxiety to everyone, including myself, I have to admit. And part of one of the things I discovered was my infant daughter needed bonding time. She would lay on my chest, and we spent hours and hours and hours sort of in relationship that way. I could kind of roll over and change her, and we created a little haven on my bed that was, sort of Marie space and mommy space and Nancy actual mental person with intellect space, because sometimes mommy and intellect space, especially in those early stages. But one of the things that we, the anxiety that we sort of had to cope with from lots of folks highlighted this, the way in which the politics of care necessitate certain absolute capacities from the caregiver, rather than the notion that care is always in relationship to a particular situation. And that's the dilemma of some of that essentializes it. It's kind of that caregivers have to have all of these things, instead of that certain circumstances will call out different kinds of things from a common experience of care. And then I started trying to find research about women mothers with disabilities. And I was really stunned. There's stuff on the pregnancy, because that's often the kind of most challenging piece. And then after that, it's like, until college, you're on your own. And I found myself a little unnerved. But one of the research findings I did find was a study out of Berkeley, California, and women, their mothers with disabilities, who had gathered and done research together for now almost 12 years. And they've done a national study of children who are being parented by a mother with a disability. And one of the things they found is they did a control, and it's a legitimate sociological study too, they did a control. One of the things they found was children of mothers with disability have a greater sense of personal efficacy. And I began to think about that idea as a way to think about what is it God is trying to foster in us? What is it that God tries to foster in us? Is it that God has called us to both mutual, and it's absolutely this relationship of interdependence that creates efficacy, right? It's not autonomy that creates efficacy, but rather the necessity of help. My daughter, from very early on, helped mommy with my shoes. She loves now helping with socks. And this was not just something that, you know, you kind of let a toddler do. This was actual support. And that's one of those things that is, you know, it's still one of, I can't really make full sense of this. How do we find ways to actually admit need in the circumstances of real asymmetry of power and real asymmetry of need, right? What I need from her isn't as great as what she needs from me. Nonetheless, we both need things in the creation of this mutual dependence. And part of what this my work in this is to use Trinitarian theology to think about mutual dependence and fullness in the dependence in relation, and then the ways in which that can be modeled in human society, in which there really are not just quite divisions of labor, but differences of power. If you think that there was an intentional relational power in the Trinity in certain ways, I'm not sure exactly how that works. I've been in conversation with colleagues that when I say that, some of them say, you know, because then that would imply one was not as powerful, and I'm trying to figure out what that might mean. But I do have a sense that there's absolute mutual dependence, right? And if mutual dependence has to include a notion of power, right? It has to include some notion of power. So part of this work that I'm doing now and that I invite you to help me with is to figure out how do we understand care when we don't have designated givers and designated receivers that are classes of people. When we understand care as an activity that circulates always in relationship to power, but always also in relationship to differential need. Right? So, you know, I mean, I'm not going to, I wish I could wrap it up nicely and neatly and give you it in a package, but I'm going to invite you to think with me, and maybe with a partner. It's sort of hard in some of these contexts to sort of do it, and I'll see if it works in the large group, and then if it doesn't, we'll go to a partner. To think about the single most significant time in your life in which you had the experience of dependence that you can recall, right? Not just that you can recall. When were you dependent, physically dependent on another, as well as emotionally, socially, maybe even spiritually? Does that come to mind? Then think of the relations that surrounded that. Was it always a stable getter and a giver in relationship to that? Was it one person that cared for you in that circumstance, or was the designated carer in many of those circumstances? Use that, you know, that sort of mental image of yourself to help me think together and help us think together about how do you think about the nature of caregiving in God's community and in our own personal spiritual lives? How do we think about dependence, independence, interdependence, mutual dependence? We've got all these words, and they are extremely fuzzy, and they certainly are what we experience, but they're hard to find ways to kind of build into a story about the ways in which God is promoting among us efficacy. That's my other piece I wanted to think. And then I wanted to think, you know, was it stable giver and getter? And then what did that feeling promote in you? What did that feeling of dependence, was it a sense of disgust, failure? Or was that care given in ways that allowed you to feel
full personhood, even as you were absolutely dependent on another. Anybody have a story they might be willing to share? That's a tough one. I'll tell you one of my own first, if you want me to, but I don't want to forestall conversation. So, please, my friend.
Well, it came to mind right away when I had cancer, and I was totally dependent, but it was the most freeing time of my life. I would never change that. I don't want it again.
Mm-hmm.
No. But I thought of many relationships, you know, and that people that came, and I also thought of ones that asked more of me, and it wasn't mutual. Mm-hmm. It was like, I don't need those people right now.
Right.
And I mean, well-meaning, and, but they wanted to be more caring than
they
to
wanted
get
into
a relationship with me during that time. But I think it was freeing in that I learned how to receive, and also in that receiving, something went out of me back into the relationships. Many stories I could tell with those kids.
Nancy Mayers, who is a kind of key person in the development of feminist disability theology, has written a book, Waist High in the World, and she has progressive MS. And in these later years have been very, very dependent on her husband and her children and professional caregivers. And one of the things she talks about is that being able to receive care has been for her a vital part of this sense of mutual relationship and to be a good mother. She talks about how being able to receive the care of her children has made her a better mother. And that has really challenged me to think about this. How does that work? How do you work in that idea? Anybody else have experiences that they can come
in? Yeah, I was raised in an American Circuit Lutheran home where the definition of roles is very distinct. And my husband was also, and then later in life, after having been a nurse, I was called to go back for medical school. So I had to learn about the different types of caregiving anyway, and we were raising two small children at the time. And so there was a lot of, I'll be home at 5:30, you pick up the kids at 5:45, we'll grab dinner and then we'll go. And all the time, my childhood tapes playing, you should be making dinner, you should be cleaning the house, you should be taking the kids to afternoon play classes, you should be. And it really did get to be very paralyzing and depressing for a while, just because, you know, this is what I was defined to be, and this is what I'm becoming, and where do we find a happy medium, and who am I hurting in the process, based on the old definitions?
Mm-hmm.
And it was very humbling at times to have to say to my husband, will you make dinner tonight? Will you, you know, or sometimes angering to saying, come on, I'm doing all this, when are you going to do this part, you know, and both of us really had to do a lot of growing during that time, and yet through that process, now I can look and think, wow, you know, I have received just as much from my kids on the journey as I hope they've received from us, but it's totally a different function than what it was when I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to almost completely, I mean, you appreciate what you received from that time, but you have to look at it in a whole different perspective.
There is, Frances Young in Britain talks about how notions of mothering have not, she argues, they've not altered since Victorian times. I'm not sure if I'm willing to go, we'll go with her that far. But one of the basic things she talks about is that there still is this basic notion of complementarity in caring, right? Male gives certain kind of care, male father gives certain kind of care, mother gives this specific kind of care, which is nurturance, moral the care of the food, right? And even if we decide in our various decisions with family to do it that way, the notion of how is it that care circulates is still something we have to really discuss and figure out in order to make sure no one feels more dependent and more, not only more dependent, but less appreciated in their form of care as well. So I mean, just on that practical level. Anybody else have things they might phrase with their own experience?
I find as I get older now that I have disabilities, they may not be obvious, but they're definitely there. For several years, I was the caregiver for a husband who had dementia, and I know what it needs, what it means for someone to be dependent. But I would not go downstairs anymore unless there is a railing that I could hang on. When I came here, I found that my hearing had deteriorated to the point that I wasn't able, I can hear you very well, you have a good voice, but I was dependent and I couldn't hear many of the speakers. Found that they did have a hearing apparatus that I've been able to use. Otherwise, I'd love to come here, but it would have been in vain unless I'd had some kind of help. I find that when I walk with my friend, I hang onto her arm. Your classes made me realize that I do, in a way, have a disability. I still have a great zest for life when I want to participate in, but I need crutches. I need helps.
Yeah, I think those two things aren't in contradiction. I think that the zest for life and the need of help, that's the challenge, is that we can have both and live fully.
And you were talking about people not being aware of what some of us need. It has been true in our church now that they, rather than have to walk up steps to the altar, they have a ramp. They have accommodations now and elevators, so usually we used to have to walk up steps. We have an elevator now for those who cannot handle it. But there is a lot of thought to be given to those that are aging. I'm hitting 90 this year, so, and I still feel I want to participate, but I do need help.
Absolutely. And that's an ordinary part of human life.
I'm really interested in how our conversation around material, it's almost as though our physical acknowledging or coming into our physical limitations, as we do that together, we move more deeply into emotional relationship with others. And so it really seems as though in the stories that have been shared that as we experience limitation physically and are on these mutual sides of caregiving and care receiving, that is the site of emotional, spiritual, perhaps, engagement. And I wonder about how that plays out in terms of the Trinity as we think about kind of Trinitarian relationships. Is there a difference within Trinitarian relationships in terms of kind of material difference or substantive difference and emotional difference and how
that's
that plays out?
That's a good distinction. That's very interesting. And I think it is, once we admit to one another and ourselves that we do need, right? Not just in principle need. You know, I mean, all of us came from in principle need. But when we say, you know, this is a real particular, or this is a real thing I have, and then we do have a sense of moving toward. I think many people do, right? And not everyone does have that sense. Please.
I think that it's very important also for the caregiver to realize they have to take care of themselves. Not only am I a nurse, my older sister died recently, and my mother is the woman with the walker, who is now losing her sight and has moved in with me, so now my role, you know, has completely reversed to be, you know, caregiver to my mother.
And I wonder if it's possible, my mom came down after the second surgery, after Marie came, I was on my back, and she was no longer quite as able to stay on the bed the full time, so my mom came down and helped me for 3.5 months. And my mom and I were talking about that. I was just beginning to kind of do this, and she was talking about what a gift it was for her to be able to know me and her granddaughter, and how much, even though I felt so dependent on her, and such, in some ways, it still, when I talk about it, brings up this emotional sense, because it was such a gift for her to decide, I'll leave this and I'll come and do this. But she was saying, you know, I've never gotten a chance to live with a grandchild and be with them day, morning and night. And so I understood, even as she had to provide care again after that season of mothering, there were ways in which inviting her into my need had given her certain kinds of gifts, and that's a challenge to figure out that negotiation. I do think it has to be negotiated and articulated a good bit. It's tough.
And it's very difficult in this day for families to do this because so many people work. They have scattered. And I mean, hospitals have had to change their rules that it is only family members. It has to be looked at as, you know, extended, you know, families, whether, you know, it's with a disability or not. If they're in the hospital, it is a disability of some sort.
They need support.
Well, I'm sitting here thinking of this. I'm part of a Washington Trails Association work team who's here this week, and we're working on trails. And I am the least experienced member in the group as far as hiking goes. I have bad knees, and we've been hiking way, way up high to work on trails. And the members in the group have been so good to me. And I was thinking about this in terms of, because in my life, right now, I'm helping my daughter with my ex-husband who has early onset Alzheimer's. And I'm thinking, I mean, it's a good thing because I'm seeing how kind and how accepting my team members are of me, and it makes me think how I can be more kind and accepting, because it's hard to work with somebody with Alzheimer's, especially when they're your ex-husband. That's a complication. But he's in a Tacoma Lutheran home.
Yeah.
And they really are very good there. But this has helped me kind of, maybe in my personal care of him, be more appreciative of his gifts. And because I'll get from this, I'm sure, but patience if nothing else.
And I think what I have learned as I've worked with this mothering literature is part of the challenge. One of the things that women, mothers with disabilities, have to do is increase the circle. Mm-hmm. Right? My husband, myself, and my daughter, we can't make it on our own. I don't think any nuclear families can, actually, but I think admitting that we can't make it is part of increasing that circle in which we have friends and supporters and other cousins, Marie has, you know, that she is able to draw from, so that when we think about this, this relationships and who gets and who gives, if we've increased the circle, then it isn't this kind of exchange theory always, you know, okay, it's my turn to get, you give now. And that can be deadly in intimate relationships over time. You know, it's like, either when it's stable or when it shifts, you know, and there is this sort of my turn, your turn, my turn, your turn, that can be really trapped. So I think that part of what I've learned is the networking, the necessity, and I guess that's what makes me think of the Trinity, right? Why not monotheism? Why not? Well, because the experience of mutuality adds to us all. Anybody who would like to share?
From a different angle, I was really struck both because of the title, The Politics of Care, and then your definition, the first phrase, disability is a cultural interpretation. And I have been very aware of the politics of how my culture defines what is normal. Mm-hmm. I have very limited energy, and so even though intellectually I'm quite capable, for some reason, not only construction workers, but academics have to work 60 to 80 hours a week, as though stamina is linked to intellectual ability. And so I'm very aware that the culture, if I lived in a culture that was much slower paced, and, you know, there are a lot of cultures in the world that are still like that, I would not be seen as having a disability at all.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, and a very good
I mean, the ways in which our culture defines things, I think right now we are in a crisis in relationship to elementary education, in relationship to this defining children. Certainly there are cognitive and chemical issues going on, but there are also ways in which we have culturally created elementary classes so that the ordinary activities of children are deemed inappropriate. And so I think you're exactly right to demonstrate some of the ways in which we culturally speed up and push folks makes it produces disability as well as compounds impairment in various ways. So thank you. And I want to reiterate, just as we conclude, my experience overwhelmingly is with a physical disability, and I use that, but I hope that those of you with other forms of disability and other ways of thinking about it will really contribute that, because I'm not intending to exclude, but it's simply not as easily there in my mind, because I don't have those experiences. So thank you. Thank you for your time. It's a lovely day, and you didn't have to stay in Paris this whole hour. So, thank you.
Thank you.